Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today, we listen to another segment of What It Takes, a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. Later, I have a report on a new video sharing website all about love and marriage. And as always, we close the show with an American story. But first, Phil Dierking tells us about a new report from the research and policy organization Freedom House.
The democracy monitoring group Freedom House says governments from Central Europe to Eurasia are showing disrespect for independent agencies and open discussion. It adds that the European Union, or EU, and the United States have little time left to stand up to the area's anti-democratic forces. Freedom House released the findings in its latest Nations in Transit report, which is called Confronting Illiberalism. The report defines illiberalism as thinking that rejects the need for independent agencies to monitor the government and dismisses the idea of publicly disagreeing with those in power. Freedom House said that in 2017, illiberalism established itself as the new normal in the former Soviet Union and some of its allies. The U.S.-based group noted attacks on independent media and government critics in a number of countries. And it observed a never-ending push in some areas to combine the ruling party and the state. Nate Schenken is project director of Nations in Transit for Freedom House. He said his group has been speaking out about these issues for a long time in places like Russia, Central Asia, and Belarus. Schenken told Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, that increasingly, we see this now in Central Europe, in countries like Hungary and Poland. We see it starting to have an effect at the level of institutions. So, very dramatic changes, especially in Poland, he said. The report said that 19 out of the 29 nations in the study received lower democracy ratings than last year, the sharpest drop in the project's 23-year history. It also found that for the second time in 2 years, the number of consolidated authoritarian governments was higher than that of consolidated democracies. The report said that Turkmenistan was the area's worst performer for what the report calls Eurasia's entrenched autocracies. An autocracy is a system of government where one person has unlimited powers. The report identified entrenched autocracies in 5 other countries. They are Belarus, Russia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan. The report said that Russian President Vladimir Putin won re-election last month in a political campaign where he faced no real competition. It said his only real opponent, anti-corruption activist Alexei Navalny, was barred from being a candidate after he was found guilty of corruption charges. The report questions the believability of the ruling, however. In addition, the report noted that Russia is facing economic decay. It said this has resulted from a lack of structural reforms, its support of separatists in eastern Ukraine, and international actions against Russia for taking control of the Crimean Peninsula. Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Armenia, and Kyrgyzstan have the area's highest risk of moving into authoritarianism, the report said. The window for fundamental reforms may not have closed in Ukraine, the report said, but, it noted, political resistance to anti-corruption reforms, attacks on civil society, and the media. As a result, the report said Ukraine's democracy rating was lower for the first time since 2014. It was a relatively small decline, but it was meaningful, Shenkin said. He added that the main cause is the pressure leading Ukrainian politicians have put on civil society and independent media. The report said the weakening of democracy was most striking in two Eastern European countries, Poland and Hungary. It noted the two were successful in separating from authoritative systems in the 1980s. In 2017, the Polish government passed laws that give the ruling party-controlled parliament more influence in choosing Supreme Court members and other judges. In addition, Hungary passed laws in 2017 to limit the freedom of people to publicly critique the government. Freedom House is a U.S. government-financed non-government organization. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and VOA are each part of the U.S. government-supported Broadcasting Board of Governors. I'm Phil Dierking.
Videos on Love Stories TV website have drama, romance, and beautiful clothes mixed with costly settings and highly technical camera shots. Is it Hollywood or is it real life? Sometimes the line seems to disappear. Love Stories TV shows videos of people getting married and taking part in different events leading up to the big moment, their wedding day. Many modern-day wedding videos now compete for production values with Hollywood movies. Rachel Silver is the founder and head of Love Stories TV, a website for watching and sharing wedding videos. Silver says she got the idea for the site from talking to women she worked with. They told her how they had begun to watch wedding videos with their girlfriends one night and could not stop. Silver remembers looking at some videos herself.
I was thinking, this is the best content I've ever seen. It's real people, real stories, but professional production.
Silver says Love Stories TV now has thousands of wedding films from around the world. Some come from newlyweds. Filmmakers also offer videos to the site. The videos often include information about the videographers, food, flower providers, clothing makers, and other services used. One can watch the videos just for fun, but they can also help people in planning for their own wedding day. Wedding services information is searchable on the site by subject, including place, religion, and culture. Carly Caro got married last December. She said she had no problems sharing her video with Love Stories TV. She said it took 30 seconds to post the film. Caro said she wanted to make things easier for others planning a wedding. She said she thinks people struggle about budgeting for a wedding video. Hopefully, she said, they'll be inspired to spend the money and understand the importance and the value in the long run. So, who exactly is watching the videos on Love Stories TV? Is there really an audience for the wedding videos of strangers? Rachel Silver said users of the website are mostly young and female.
Many of our viewers have grown up on reality TV. The Bachelor has been on television their entire lives. It's about the love story. Inevitably in a wedding film, it comes out how you met, how you fell in love. They interview the friends and the family members.
In the future, Silver plans to offer a targeted marketing service for wedding-related businesses. They will be able to pay monthly to reach viewers. Love Stories TV is also partnering with companies like the menswear business Bonobos. Critics may dismiss the married people on Love Stories TV as self-congratulatory, but Silver argues that posting videos is no different from publishing wedding announcements in the New York Times or Town and Country magazine. Silver said she wishes she had documented her own wedding, like those with videos on Love Stories TV.
All of their family and friends and the people they love the most are surrounding them, and that only happens to you a handful of times in your entire life.
Next up, what it takes. The subject today is American writer and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin.
I often root my love of history to the days when I was only 6 years old, and my father taught me that mysterious and wondrous art of keeping score so that when he went to work during the day, I could record the history of that day's Brooklyn Dodger game, play by play, inning by inning. He would come home at night and sit on the porch and listen for two excruciating hours as I went through everything that had happened that day. Well, when you're only 6 years old and your father thinks you're doing great as a miniature historian, it's a great impetus to keep it up later in life. In fact, he made it even more special for me because he never told me in those early days that all of this was actually described in great detail in the sports pages of the newspapers the next day. So I thought without me, he wouldn't even know what happened to the Brooklyn Dodgers, which meant that history had a magic from that day that it still holds to this.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is talking here at an Academy of Achievement Summit in 1996, the year after she won the Pulitzer Prize.
My mother was very sick from the time I was born and died when I was 14. So I think my love of books in some ways came from knowing that she was pretty much bound to the home and read all the time as a way of learning about other worlds that she would never be able to experience because she couldn't travel very much because of her heart condition. So books took on a certain kind of magic for me, just as the baseball scores did. So between those two experiences, somehow history and reading became a very important part of my childhood.
Later, Goodwin says, after she'd been to college and graduate school, she met the person who would have the most influence on her particular approach to writing. Lyndon Johnson, a man she got to know extremely well, and the subject of her first book.
I knew I was interested in American history and government, so I thought instead of just reading about it, I better find out about it in practical terms. So one summer I worked in the House of Representatives, another summer I worked in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and another summer I worked in the State Department, and then eventually I became a White House Fellow and worked for Lyndon Johnson. And that probably was the single most important experience in orienting me to want to do presidential history because I got to know this crazy character when I was only 23 years old.
There's a great story I want to interject here that Goodwin told during a commencement speech she delivered in the 1980s at Dartmouth College. After she was chosen as a White House Fellow, but before she'd actually moved to Washington, President Johnson discovered that she'd been an activist in the anti-Vietnam War movement. She'd even written an article called How to Dump Lyndon Johnson. Goodwin was sure she'd get kicked out of the program, but instead, LBJ just said, "Bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can."
He's still the most formidable fascinating, frustrating, irritating individual I think I've ever known in my entire life. He was huge. I mean, just as a huge character, not only standing 6'4", but when you talk to him, he violated the normal human space between people. So he would be right on top of you. You'd be sort of looking up into his chest. He had an enormous voice. He was a great storyteller. The problem was that half his stories I discovered weren't true. There was this great time I was swimming with him in this pool that he has at his ranch. It's an amazing pool that he created so that it could be a working pool. So at every moment when you're trying to swim in it, floating rafts came by with floating telephones on top of them, other floating rafts with floating desks and notepads. And in the middle of it, I had read an article that day by Hugh Seide, a reporter, who had said that Johnson had given a great speech to the troops who were going to Vietnam in which he talked about patriotism. And in the speech, he mentioned that his great-great-grandfather had died at the Battle of the Alamo. And Hugh Seide said it was a wonderful speech. The only problem was that he didn't have a great-great-grandfather who died at the Alamo. He just wanted to have one so much that he'd kind of made him up. So I turned to President Johnson. I said, how can you do that? And he looked back at me and he said, oh, these journalists, they're such sticklers for detail. And it was then that I realized that I could only believe half of what he told me. But the stories were so much fun and he loved politics. And even though his presidency was in many ways scarred forever by the war in Vietnam and destroyed in a lot of ways, he as a character was even larger than his presidency. So being able to get to know him well, I worked for him the last year in the White House and then helped him on his memoirs the last 4 years of his life before he died, spending summers and Christmases and every other weekend at the ranch. So that firsthand relationship with this large character, I think, is what drew me to writing books about presidents. That was my first book on Lyndon Johnson, and then the Kennedys and then the Roosevelts came after that.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Here is the first part of Willa Cather's short story, Paul's Case.
Paul hated school. He did not do his homework. He did not like his teachers. Paul's father did not know what to do with him. His teachers did not know either. One afternoon, all his teachers at Pittsburgh High School met together with him to discuss his case. Paul was late. When he entered the room, his teachers sat waiting for him. He was tall for his age and very thin. His clothes were too small for him, but they were clean. He had a bright red flower in the buttonhole of his black jacket. One of the teachers asked Paul why he had come to the meeting. Paul said politely that he wanted to do better in school. This was a lie. Paul often lied. His teachers began to speak. They had many complaints. One said Paul talked to the other students instead of paying attention to the lessons. Another said Paul always sat in class with his hands covering his eyes. A third teacher said Paul looked out the window instead of looking at her. His teachers attacked him without mercy. Paul's eyebrows moved up and down as his teacher spoke. His smile never left his face, but his fingers shook as he touched the flower on his coat. At last, the meeting was over. Paul's smile got even wider. He bowed gracefully and left the room. His teachers were angry and confused. The art teacher spoke for all of them when he said there was something about Paul that he didn't understand. "I don't think he really means to be bad," he said. "There's just something wrong with that boy." Then the art teacher remembered one warm afternoon when Paul had fallen asleep in his class. Paul's face was white with thin blue veins under the skin. The boy's face looked tired and lined, like an old man's. His eyebrows moved up and down, even in his sleep. After he left the meeting, Paul ran down the hill from the school, whistling. He was late for his job at the concert hall. Paul was an usher there. He showed people to their seats. He carried messages for them. He brought them their programs with a polite bow. Everyone thought he was a charming boy and the best usher at the hall. When Paul reached the concert hall that evening, he went immediately to the dressing room. About six boys were already there. Paul began changing his clothes with excited hands. He loved his green uniform with the gold pockets and design. Paul rushed into the concert hall as soon as he had changed clothes. He ran up and down the hall, helping people. He became more and more excited. His face became pink, and his eyes seemed larger and very bright. He looked almost handsome. At last, everyone was seated. The orchestra began to play, and Paul sat down with a sigh of relief. The music seemed to free something in Paul's spirit. Then a woman came out and began to sing. She had a rich, strong soprano voice. Paul felt truly happy for the first time that day. At the end of the concert, Paul went back to the dressing room. After he had changed his clothes again, he went outside the concert hall. He decided to wait for the singer to come out. While he waited, he looked across the street to the large hotel called the Schenley. All the important people stayed at the Schenley when they visited Pittsburgh. Paul had never been inside it, but he used to stand near the hotel's wide glass doors. He liked to watch the people enter and leave. He believed if he could only enter this kind of a hotel, he would be able to leave school, his teachers, and his ordinary gray life behind him forever. At last, the singer came out of the concert hall. Paul followed her as she walked to the hotel. He was part of a large crowd of admirers who had waited to see her. When they all reached the hotel, she turned and waved. Then the doors opened and she disappeared inside. Paul stared into the hotel as the doors slowly closed. He could feel the warm, sweet air inside. And for a moment, he felt part of a golden world of sparkling lights and marble floors. He thought about the mysterious dishes of food being served in the hotel's dining room. He thought about green bottles of wine growing cold in silver buckets of ice. He turned away from the hotel and walked home. He thought of his room, with its horrible yellow wallpaper, the old bed, with its ugly red cover. He shook his head. Soon, he was walking down the street where he lived. All the houses on Cordelia Street were exactly alike. Middle-class businessmen had bought them for their families. All their children went to school and to church. They loved arithmetic. As Paul walked toward his house, he felt as if he were drowning in ugliness. He longed for cool colors and soft lights and fresh flowers. He didn't want to see his ugly bedroom or the cold bathroom with its cracked mirror and gray floor. Paul went around to the back of his father's house. He found an open window and climbed into the kitchen. Then he went downstairs to the basement. He was afraid of rats, but he did not want to face his own bedroom. Paul couldn't sleep. He sat on the floor and stared into the darkness until morning came. The following Sunday, Paul had to go to church with his family. Afterwards, everyone came home and ate a big dinner. Then all the people who lived on Cordelia Street came outside to visit each other. After supper, Paul asked his father if he could visit a friend to get some help with his arithmetic. Paul left the house with his school books under his arm, but he didn't go to his friend's house. Instead, he went to see Charlie Edwards. Charlie was a young actor. Paul liked to spend as much time as he could at the theater, where Charlie Edwards and his group acted in their plays. It was only at the theater and the concert hall that Paul felt really alive. The moment he smelled the air of these places, he felt like a prisoner suddenly set free. As soon as he heard the concert hall orchestra play, he forgot all the ugly, unpleasant events in his own life. Paul had discovered that any kind of music awakened his imagination. Paul didn't want to become a musician, however. He didn't want to become an actor, either. He only wanted to be near people who were actors and musicians. He wanted to see the kind of life these artists led. Paul found the schoolroom even worse after a night at the theater or the concert hall. He hated the school's bare floors and cracked walls. He turned away from his dull teachers in their plain clothes. He tried to show them how little he thought of them and the studies they taught. He would bring photographs of all the actors he knew to school. He would tell the other students that he spent his evenings with these people at elegant restaurants. Then he would announce that he was going away to Europe or to California or to Egypt for a while. The next day, he would come to school smiling nervously. His sister was ill, he would say, but he was still planning to make his trip next spring. Paul's problems at school became worse. Even after the meeting with his teachers, things did not get better. He told them he had no time to study grammar and arithmetic. He told them he had to help the actors in the theater. They were old friends of his. Finally, his teachers went to Paul's father. He took Paul out of school and made him get a job. He told the manager at the concert hall that Paul could not work there anymore. His father warned the doorman at the theater not to let Paul into the place. And Charlie Edwards promised Paul's father not to see Paul again. All the actors at the theater laughed when they heard about the stories Paul had been telling. The women thought it was funny that Paul had told people he took them out to nice restaurants and sent them flowers. They agreed with the teachers and with his father that Paul's was a bad case.
We will continue the Willa Cather story, Paul's Case, next week. But now we have to say goodbye. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.